Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is a place with unnaturally blue skies and empty beaches surveyed by families in red jumpers and occasionally haunted by enormous good luck kittens as we investigate picture postcards and explore what it was that caused us to hold on to these little ephemeral rectangles. Each time, I welcome two guests, and it's their postcards that act as small clues to direct us towards memories, mysteries, and stories. I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm delighted to say that today my guests are historian and screenwriter Alex von Tunzelman and theatre director, writer Jack McNamara. Jack and Alex, welcome to Podcast from the Past.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Jack McNamara is currently artistic director of the award-winning touring company New Perspectives, based in Nottingham. As well as touring shows around rural communities, he has specialised in bringing theatre or theatre experiences to a variety of unlikely and innovative spaces, from WhatsApp platforms to cassette tape, and his latest projects involve delivering dramatic stories to letterboxes around the world via postcards. You get the connection. We're going to hear more about this postcard project. I've got a lot of questions. But Jack, you join us today with a Bangkok postmark on you, is that right?
Yeah, thinking about a place that's had a big impact on me, I guess. I had a strange episode in my life where my family all moved to Thailand for 3 years. I was there from the age of 9 to 12. And it had a huge, you know, it's such a kind of sensory explosion of a place, particularly coming from Europe. So it was just, you know, it was almost a trauma when I started there. But then I kind of settled into the trauma. And then really, I think ever since I've been away from there, I've kind of yearned for some of that noise and mess and craziness. Yeah.
Is it somewhere you go back to?
I've not been back. So that's why it's even more strange and kind of dreamlike. I saw a film called Syndromes in a Century, which I kind of saw by accident, which is set in Bangkok. And it just completely kind of took me back. It was amazing. It just captured exactly the spirit of the place that I remembered. Wow. So that's the closest I've been back to it, really.
Very good. Well, it's part of you. Now, as I've said, you're currently involved professionally sending postcards. And there's a job that not many people get to do. We're going to talk about that in a bit. But when you're off duty, when you're not doing these projects, do you still send postcards?
Yeah, I really like to, where possible. My handwriting is really, really bad. So it's sort of a source
That's a
of
problem,
shame.
Isn't it?
It is a bit. It's getting worse. But yeah, I do. If you can find a good postcard, I always prefer that, if possible, to send someone.
Very good. Now, I don't want to tease the listeners too much longer. So just can you just unpack for us, just in a couple of sentences at this stage, the mechanics, what it is that your postcard theatre project is?
Well, it was back when lockdown first began, and a part of our work as a theatre company is rural touring, which is very intimate, very close, very tactile. You know, it's not glamorous at all. And the loss of that really made me think about how to replace it with something that had the same sense of intimacy. And, you know, I knew that the kind of art world was going online but that a lot of our rural audiences wouldn't take to that. So quite early on, I had this feeling that we could reach people via this postcard medium in a way that would actually feel quite special and quite kind of handheld. So this is a total experiment, but what I did was I wrote a series, a narrative in six parts across six postcards. And the idea was they arrive at your house, you know, weekly, so that you kind of piece together this story over 6 weeks. It didn't quite work out like that because mail was totally and utterly erratic.
Things were waiting forever, weren't they?
And people were getting the last postcard first and the third. So my structure was just completely a joke. But it really took off as an idea. So you know, we did a kind of free run to a couple of hundred homes to begin with, and people got really excited by it. And then it kind of went on and on, and then we ended up, we've now posted it to 26 countries around the world.
Unbelievable.
And we time it better now so that you do actually get them in order. So that's been a big breakthrough for us.
How do you get a response? Because theatre is immediate. That's kind of the whole point. Do people have to send you back a postcard saying, yes, very good, enjoyed that? Or how does it work?
Well, yeah, the last postcard in the series, we had a seventh one, which is a kind of feedback postcard. So we do kind of invite them to send us whatever they thought using that same medium. Having started on that form, it felt right to end on that form. But yeah, and interestingly, it hasn't really, it's always stayed quite kind of analog. We haven't had that much feedback on sort of Twitter or email. It's all kind of like, you know, old-fashioned handwriting feedback, which is kind of great in a way.
So somehow you've got people into that mode. They're in that mode when they're thinking about it.
Exactly.
Very good. Well, we'll find out very specifically about some of these in a moment. Now, you may know Alex von Tunzelmann from her writing in The Guardian or The Telegraph or elsewhere. You may have read her history books on the Suez Crisis, Indian independence, the Cold War in the Caribbean, or even seen the film Churchill, for which she wrote the screenplay. Her most recent book, which is out, I think, last week at the time I'm saying these words, is Fallen Idols, which is a gripping, funny, urgent, necessary scamper through the stories of statues, memorial statues, the statues of great men that are designed to loom over us, but occasionally don't last into eternity as perhaps they were intended, and the story of how those statues toppled over from George III to Saddam to Colston and beyond. Now, Alex comes to us today with a BN1 postmark, I think I can see. What does that mean?
Well, that's Central Brighton, which is where mostly where I grew up. I moved there when I was a pretty small child. I thought a lot about this because there's so many places that are affecting me. And as you said, I've written history books about all sorts of different parts of the world, and all of those places have really affected me and changed my views in fascinating ways. But
this is researching personally on the ground somewhere different from London.
Absolutely. And which, you know, those wonderful memories of those days that we could actually just sort of get on a plane and go around the world and visit different places and meet new people. But I think when you asked me this question, I just felt like I kind of wanted to bring it back to a place that really I kind of felt formed me, and I think it probably did. I think I was very lucky to grow up in a town like Brighton, which was, you know, quite diverse and cosmopolitan and interesting and full of different ideas and quite creative. So I think that has probably really affected me.
And full of postcards, I might add.
Absolutely full of them. There's actually, I think it might still be there, there's an old postcard shop there that I was completely obsessed with.
I am familiar with the shop, yes.
Yeah, I bet you are, yes.
But I must say, the postcards on the seafront, on the carousels last time I was there, which would have been obviously before lockdown, were looking a little bit forlorn. It's like they were hangovers from two or three seasons ago and were curling up at the edges a bit.
Yes, they're probably all a bit frayed now, aren't we all? I mean, after the last year and a half. Who knows? Who knows what we'll see in the future? But I do think the Seaside Postcard is also, yeah, for me, very redolent of that history. I do quite love them because, yes, I love the sort of slightly garish colours and, you know, rather artificial looking views of Brighton seafront. I find incredibly evocative, actually.
And you're not scared of putting jokes in your history books either?
No, I think they're actually quite essential. I think people kind of have various assumptions about history that I find fascinating, including that everybody in history was very, very serious. And
because they're dead.
You know, yeah, exactly. And couldn't possibly have ever had a joke or enjoyed anything. And I think sometimes historical jokes don't translate particularly well. You know, certain humorous references or whatever definitely go by the by. But I think it's really important that we understand that people are people and, you know, do silly things in the past just as much as they still do silly things today.
So, Alex, when did you last send a postcard?
I think it must have been quite a while ago. I mean, you know, obviously lockdown notwithstanding and all of that. Although I do, oh, I suppose actually that's probably true. I do sometimes send them just out of fun. So actually it was quite recent because when my book came out, I sent a few copies to some people that had helped me with it and included some postcards with it. And I had to just go through. So like, I realise that you probably are way ahead of me on this, but I do have a stack of beautiful postcards that I love in a drawer, just waiting to find the right moment for people to receive them. And so so I dug through and saw what I could find. And indeed, I did have a lovely, very old 1980s postcard from Trafalgar Square with Nelson with a pigeon on his head. So
yes.
So
probably our most famous statue, in fact.
Absolutely. So so that one did go to
somebody. Hell of a day when that one's pulled down.
Well, that's a big one. That'd be hard to get down. I think he's all right at the moment. I think he's pretty safe.
Yes. He was pretty unpopular even when he was alive, I think, actually.
Well, they often were. Probably why they had to put him so high up so you can't get to him.
Well, maybe that's part of the sort of correlation of the size of the statue. We'll go into that later. Now, before we see and hear about the cards that Alex and Jack have brought along, I'll give you a quick one of mine. This is, of course, a postcard from the past card, like I do on Twitter and in my book. It's an old card from which I've selected a part of the message. Now, because we're recording this remotely, we've all got sort of dope sheets with pictures on. So, and at home you can see them on the website. But this is a picture. It looks like a dry stone wall in a landscape. It's actually Gordale Scar in Yorkshire. A very sort of mossy green colour. And the Frank on it, as this wavy line Frank, has been put on so heavily that there's a sort of embossed effect on the front of the card. It looks like, I don't know what it looks like, but it's a wavy line from one side to the other. It's sort of effectively cancelled on both sides. Isn't that the story of our time? Cancelled on both sides. Anyway, so this is from 1974, sent to Rochester in Kent. It's not really a joke. It just sums up certain experiences we probably had with English holidays. So Ray says, "Dear all, arrived safely. Conditions bearable. Food okay. Weather worse than Dorset. Spent today in two jumpers, jacket, cagoule, scarf, trouser and over trousers. Just about warm. You wouldn't believe the cold on the moors." So, I mean, that's... But it was worth going. It was worth doing it. I'll do another quick one. This is a very pretty card. This isn't on your dope sheet, folks. It will be at home. But it's a picture of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, taken, I think, from the Champs-Élysées, from the roof of a building on the Champs-Élysées, by the looks of it. One of the great memorials, Alex, that one, obviously, with statues
on it. Absolutely.
Pretty heroic looking, actually. It still looks rather wonderful. And it's a 60s card, I think. It's got little cars dotted around it. Very evocative. And I suppose what I liked about the message on this one is it reminds me of the magic of visiting places and how that magic can disappear when you go back to do some work somewhere. We've probably all of us experienced that, actually. So this one is sent to St. Saviour's in Jersey from someone called Ted, and they say, "My 4 days in Paris are now over. Thank heaven. Paris in the spring with your girl is very nice, but not with 40 school kids walking behind, in front and alongside you." So the romance of Paris just wasn't quite there when you had to look after all the school kids. It reminded me the first time I went to Paris for some work. And it was so different from going to Paris for fun. I actually felt cheated. I thought, oh, will Paris ever be the same again? You know, but, I got over it. Right then. for those of you at home, you can see all these cards, the correct cards, on the website, which is postcardfromthepast.co.uk, and you'll be able to see that we haven't been making this up. Now, Jack and Alex, you've both been kind enough to dig out cards for today's recording. Let's start with you, Jack. Now, the first one you've got, this is actually part of your latest version of the postcard theatre project, I think. Tell me what you've got.
Well, yeah, so it's a bit of a cheat because it's been written by me. You know, I can't
Life
claim...
would be simple if that's all you had to do, isn't it?
Exactly. So it is a cheat. But so basically, it, you know, as mentioned, we've been doing these dramas in six parts. I say drama, but really the sense of drama is only in the postcard coming through your letterbox and how incredibly exciting that is. But ultimately, the narrative is written down on them. But for this latest one, it's called Dare to Look Down, the series. And it's basically I decided to tell the story of Alton Towers over the last 150 years, because it's kind of an amazing story. So our first one, Love from Cleethorpes, was a love story told between two people. But I decided this time to kind of focus on a place. So for each card, you have a wholly different character, but they are related to Alton Towers in some way.
Is this a commission from Alton Towers, or
no? It's not. It's a commission from me to myself.
Oh, it could be. It could be.
Yeah, it is. It isn't unflattering, but it also doesn't. It doesn't. You know, sell Alton Towers today, as it were.
Right, right.
It focuses on some strange things that have happened in its history, and I picked this one. This is the fourth in the set, and this is from 1958. And I just found this a really funny moment in Alton Towers' history, which is that they tried to sort of reimagine themselves as a zoo. And I think Bernard Miles did a kind of campaign and did a kind of big advert, and everyone was very excited. And that's the front of the card is a picture of him with a pint.
And this is the actor.
The actor, exactly. Yeah. And two chimps. And we've made this up. It will do Zoo a world of good. That was kind of us being cheesy. But, you know, we were trying to kind of evoke that kind of time. But... what was funny was that they set up this zoo and then there was a cage malfunction and all the animals escaped.
You're joking.
Into the Stoke countryside, yeah. So, and apparently two anteaters were never found, which is makes its way into the story later on.
Well, I can see why you were drawn to this.
Yeah, I just think it's brilliant. I think throughout in all the cards, this is probably why it wasn't an Alton Towers commission. You know, we try and point out what's kind of bizarre and beautiful and ridiculous about such a place. So in this one, where as I said, 1958, so we just come out of the war. Well, not just come out of the war, but, you know, we were sort of a post-war kind of, you know, try and be positive. You know, it was on the brink of becoming the Alton Towers that we know today. And right. They had a really slow miniature train, which I managed to get into the story as well. But so this is basically, this is a whole other flight of fancy. One of the... people from that region at that time was Lemmy Motorhead, musician, and so I've written this in the imagined voice of Lemmy Motorhead's grandmother, who's taken him to tried to take him on his holiday to the zoo, but been deeply disappointed.
So how old would he have been at this stage?
So he'd have been 13. So he's a bit old for zoos, and she kind of talks about that.
Right.
But you know, I dug into his life a bit, and you know, he was from Stoke, but he moved to Wales with a new sort of family and had a hard time there. So this is kind of his nan kind of complaining a bit to his mum and saying, you know, I don't think his name's Ian. I don't think Ian's particularly happy.
Right, Ian Kilminster, is that right? Is that his name?
That's right, exactly. And it mentions here in the card how his mates are starting to call him Lemmy because he keeps asking them to lend him a quid. So it's a kind of little bit of history, but just a bit of, you know, an invention, really, in trying to imagine this slightly kind of tough grandmother kind of telling off Lemmy Motorhead's mum.
Can you read it for us?
Yeah, okay. So it's the 13th of August, 1958. All that fuss about the new zoo opening, get here closed, cage malfunction, half the animals escaped into town, chimps, flamingos, even a leopard. Caught them all now, but for two giant anteaters, brackets, enough to keep me up at night. Ian wasn't too bothered. 13, a bit old for zoos? Says he's still not enjoying being the only Stoke boy in Wales, but has started playing guitar and getting a bit of attention, brackets, and I know what kind. Did you know that his new nickname in school is Lemmy, because he keeps asking people to lend him a quid? Wish you'd come home, June. Says his new brother and sister still bully him and that Joe does nothing about it, mum. P.S. Gave miniature train a go, terrifying, 15 mph, nearly sick.
Very good.
So yeah, that's the That's the not quite the penultimate one. That's the fourth one in the series of six. So it goes up until the kind of the future. I write one card from the future at the very end, where Alton Towers has been scraped away and replaced by something else.
And when you receive this as part of this sort of broken, ongoing narrative, there's no further material to sort of explain it. You have to dig into it a bit as the recipient, do you, and kind of engage with it and work out where it all fits together.
That was kind of the idea, yeah, not to give too much, to kind of give strange clues, a little bit like the cards that you read out. You know, we end up having to do so much other work to picture these people. I just think that's the joy of it. And I think if you over-explain a card, you're kind of ruining the format a bit.
No, I totally agree. I think the less that one thing that always intrigues me is how much you can say with how few words. I mean, generally, I find that interesting.
Absolutely.
But certainly the postcard kind of often forces you into something close to a haiku. You know, it's just that tiny snapshot moment and hopefully well-chosen words.
Yeah, and that's been a massive challenge for me as the writer of these, to try and capture that and write in a kind of slightly blunter way that people tend to do on these cards. There's a sort of slight sense of rush sometimes.
Yes.
So, you know, you can't get too kind of flowery. There's a slight, it's almost telegram-like. You're trying to kind of pack it into a very short sentence.
Yeah, so you don't tend to have bits that join things together in a postcard. That's why you often get these funny non sequiturs, because you make it almost bullet points. You know, point one, weather this, point two, hotel this, point three, going to do this tomorrow. There isn't sort of on the other hand or meanwhile or none of those sort of conjunction bits. There's no what I would call upholstery. It's just the bare bones.
Yeah, exactly.
So when is this due to go out? When is it? Is there a plan for this to actually happen now?
Yeah, so these are on sale. Our website's newperspectives.co.uk. It's called Dare to Look Down. They're posted in later on in July, so I think there's still a few slots left. You book them. They're relatively cheap, and then they arrive at your house over a number of weeks, in order, hopefully.
Yes. I was looking the other day about some old cards from the Golden Age, sort of 1900 to 1914, and there was quite a fashion for cards with initials. The whole card was an initial letter. And they're very sweet. And if you know someone called, Terence, you can send them a tea or something. But also apparently people would buy enough to send a message. So they might buy I love you, I-L-O-V-E-Y-O. And they would send them one a week.
Brilliant.
So you have the message on the back of the card, which is obviously, your mother can read. But no one really gets to read the whole message of the bigger letters until you've received them all. So it's sort of hidden in plain sight in a way. And I thought that was rather lovely.
Lovely. Brilliant.
So, you might figure it out, though, wouldn't you, after you sort of got as far as I-L-O-V-E-Y-O. You're like, you know where this is going.
Who is this Ilovayo? Who is it? I know what your game is. But I think the idea of sending things one after the other, it's really sweet. I think it used to happen a lot in the old days that you would have this sort of sense of building up a picture across numerous cards. And I think we've sort of lost that now. I think cards are sent very much as one-offs, and in fact not even regularly anymore. As you said, Alex, we'd send them when you got the book out, when you particularly need to do a thank you or something. Very good. Well, I think it's a fantastic idea. And will there be a third?
I'm hoping to do one for children as well.
That would be great.
I think so. Yeah, I think I just think people love receiving things. You know, I think the more digital we get, the more fun it is to get something through the post that you can kind of hold and crumple up. So I'm hoping to do one for children. Towards the end of the year. But yeah, I think it's a form that has so far. It's relatively inexpensive, and it's also just great fun. So I think there's mileage in it, definitely.
Excellent. Oh, well, thank you for letting us into the world of your sort of postcard theatre. It's very interesting, very interesting. So, Alex, what's the first card you've got on your doormat?
Well, this is an old one, Tom. This is one that my nan and granddad sent me, and I can't quite make out from the Frank the full date. I think it's the 20th of August 1986, possibly it might be 88. And this is a postcard of a drawing of two young people in Seville in Spain. The young lady has a dress that has been embroidered with real thread. Very exciting.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, really such a sentimental, dreadful, cartoony picture.
isn't it? I know.
And it's very evocative, isn't it? Evocative.
It's very evocative of the time. I mean, that's sort of why I picked it. I've got a few that I've kept from my nan. Always used to send me. Definitely, my nan has written this card. My granddad did not bother. Bless him. He was absolutely lovely, but yeah, not a postcard writer. But she was an absolutely, you know, sort of rigid postcard writer. We would always get cards from wherever they went on holiday, and you can sort of, I mean, the message on the back is absolutely classic, which is, "Dear Alex, thought you and Eugenie, that's my sister, would like these cards." I think my sister got one very similar.
Sensible.
The plane was 4 hours late, so they gave us dinner at the airport. It's very hot here, underlined. Lots of love, Nan and Grandad. So that's a classic message, basically moaning about the flight.
And it's in nice capital letters so the child can read it.
She always used to write in very some neat capital letters. Although, you see, one of the reasons that this postcard actually is really quite sentimental to me is this is one of the earlier ones I've got. Later in life, unfortunately, she did develop Parkinson's disease. And if you look at the later postcards, still these block capitals, but the handwriting is much shakier. And I always sort of feel quite, you know, sort of poignancy looking back at those. She absolutely still insisted on writing them. But this one, it's still, you know, very, very clear, very strong. It also says you can tell what she was like because it says in several languages, the regulations state that this card must be sent in a sealed envelope, presumably because the thread would catch on sending machines. She's totally ignored that. It's definitely gone through the post, been franked just as it is.
Yes, so, and actually you're lucky because sometimes those regulations mean it wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah,
could have just not sent. So you
could have just been binned or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. She was living on the edge.
She was. She would do things her own way for sure. I can tell you. But yeah, I mean, it's such a funny image because I actually do remember sort of getting it, and actually I did like. She was right that I did like the dress very much, but I did not hugely like the picture of this young couple, who are indeed drawn in this really quite creepy, childlike, sentimental
way. Yes, children as adults. There's a bit of a theme of those in these holiday cards, isn't there? Rather sentimental. Yeah. Pictures, they're always a little bit unsettling.
They're pretty grim, actually. And now I sort of look back on it. I mean, they're obviously supposed to be, I think, a sort of a male and female character. But actually, to me, I like it more now. I thought they look a bit like a lesbian couple because the boy has been drawn so prettily. So
yes,
actually,
very feminine, maybe, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe they're quite cool after all. Maybe I'm into this. Maybe it's quite progressive. I doubt my nan would entirely have realised that.
Yeah. There's a word that's very overused, which is kitsch. And however, yeah. I think this is the right place to apply that word.
This is definitely full kitsch. And I think, you know, also very much from that era of Spanish holidays was still quite a cool thing to have. You know, it wasn't sort of later era when Brits would just pop over on, you know, 30 quid Ryanair flights, as many of us used to do before the pandemic, and just sort of, you know, not think about it. It was still quite an undertaking to go on a holiday to Spain. Very glamorous at that time to do such a thing. So
I love these cards where something has been added to them. I don't know, this must be done. Do you think it's machine sewn on there?
It must be. I mean, it must be, mustn't it? I mean, surely it wouldn't be worth it to get somebody to sew it because it's quite, you know, there's a lot of stitching in it. It's not particularly well done. I mean, I'm looking at it close up now and it's sort of, you know, it's a little bit scattershot in terms of where it goes. But
the effect is, you know, the colour's still really good on the thread.
It is, actually. It's really lasted. Well, I've sort of kept it in, I've got a couple of old little postcard albums just for the family ones like
Excellent.
This. So it's been well looked after, after the Postal Service impressively did deliver it despite the complete breaking of regulations.
Because the next stage of these are the ones where they have the sort of polyester flouncy dress coming out.
Oh,
sort of stuck on.
Yes, I've seen those.
They definitely couldn't go through the post, I don't think.
No,
they'd have to be in an envelope.
That would actually definitely get stuck in some kind of machine. So she wouldn't have got away with that. Maybe she sent one of those a couple of years later and it never arrived. It's also possible.
You'll never know. Handwriting or not, you'd never know.
Exactly.
So you've got a bit of a collection of these from that time?
Yeah, I've got a few. I mean, this one, as I say, there were a few others that I looked at. I don't have a huge number left. But yeah, and I think also because, you know, my nan and granddad were of that generation. They grew up in Birmingham. They always lived in Birmingham. And they'd both grown up really quite poor, but during their lives, I mean, my grandfather ran a pharmacist shop and, you know, they made a bit more money and they had and of course, this was also the era where that sort of international travel was opening up. So I think they did go on really some quite cool exotic holidays. That's sort of how they liked to spend their time. And so, you know, I have got a few from sort of all over the world, and it's kind of amazing to see now. I'm like, you know, I wouldn't mind going to some of these places myself, I have to say. Yeah. But very much that sort of that era of the world sort of opening up to people who could afford it a little bit.
And I suppose even if the messages are not formulaic, it's the wrong word, but fairly standardised, the written message, you're catching someone having a really nice time.
Yeah.
And it's an exuberant, silly card, and she's picked it specially because you're going to like it. The message is kind of positive and cheerful, despite the plane. I think these things kind of vibrate with a bit of warmth.
I think so too. And actually, looking back now, I think that's true, because, you know, with my nan and granddad, and my granddad was the kind of person who was so good with children, and he had lots of grandchildren and just absolutely adored playing with us, and was, you know, really kind of warm and open and into that. And I think my nan, you know, was much kind of better with a bit older children or adults, and so she was much less kind of rolling around playing with us, but she did always write these cards. And I think now I kind of feel really quite warm about that. I think she was, you know, very much trying to form that connection, trying to you know, kind of keep her relationship going with all her grandchildren. And, you know, I think that's really quite lovely. I think she was, this is her way of doing it.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty fundamental thing, isn't it? And then just by a freak of the fact that cardboard is resilient, you've still got it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, goodness knows, I wonder how long she thought of this, you know, thought about this postcard for. Probably not very long. I mean, at the time she...
Exactly, sitting having a lemonade at the bar or something.
Yes, exactly. Basically, you know, complaining about it being too hot, well, which is very British,
you know,
on holiday.
Have you been to southern Spain? It's very hot.
I mean, I do hear that. Actually, I would love to go to Seville. I haven't been to Seville, but...
Oh, it's a lovely city. Oh,
yeah, wow. So maybe this is what I can do.
Make
one
an
day.
Excuse, come on.
Yeah, one day I can trace her holiday journeys, although I do have another one that I nearly considered doing instead, which came from French Polynesia, and I think that might be a bit beyond my budget, I'm afraid.
Yeah, save up for that one.
Absolutely.
Very good. Now, I wanted to talk to you about statues in a very, very sort of narrow focus. I tend to think about things in narrow focuses. There's a thing you mentioned in your book, that this sort of statue mania in Europe kicked off around 1870. I think that's right. I think I'm right in saying that.
Around then, yeah.
Yeah, and that's when statues suddenly, from being dozens in, for example, London and Paris, there were hundreds.
Yes.
Of great men from the preceding few hundred years, really. That intrigued me, because that is exactly when postcards started. 1870 in this country. Now, I'm not saying one is connected to the other, but it does feel like there may somewhere be some connection between this sort of, I don't know, the industrialization of communication through the post and whatever was going on in governments and institutions' minds to wanting to put up statues. I don't know. Can you find a thread?
That's really interesting point, actually. I think
they are quite different things. So I might
they are, yeah. But on the other hand, I think there are a couple of things that probably did sort of link those. I mean, partly, I suppose, there is something about the sort of representation of the human image, which, of course, you begin to find in postcards as well.
Yeah, right, but also photography generally as well.
Yeah, photography generally, but also in the messages on postcards, that those are kind of human. And I mean, I think this sort of Victorian statue mania, I mean, I say Victorian, but actually you can absolutely see it in all European cities, and also in North America, and also then, of course, in the various colonies at that stage that were under the rule of those places, that suddenly there was this kind of boom in putting statues up. And that was very, very much linked to the sort of Victorian great man of history theory. Yes. So that, you know, history was Thomas Carlyle's theory, that history was just about the biography of great men. So it was about, and, you know, very much men, really. I mean, very few women, Queen Victoria, of course, being a bit of an exception, but usually they were men. And I think probably, you know, there is something in making a mark, perhaps. Yes. That is a bit similar with postcards, making a mark on a place or on history, taking a bit of ownership, that perhaps there is something in there that's a little bit similar. And of course,
I wonder if cities were being reinvented to some extent as well. There were big projects to rebuilding. So I know a lot of early postcards of Paris were looking at bits of Paris that were disappearing because Paris was being redeveloped. So they were catching something that had just gone. But equally, if you're doing lots of cityscapes on your postcards, you'll take pictures of the new statues as well. So there's a sort of sense that there's change going on and we're capturing that change.
Absolutely. I think there's a documenting of what's going on there a bit, which probably does kind of, you know, form a similar thing. And I suppose it is an era where, you know, more and more people are able to participate in these kind of things. You know, certainly postcards obviously are sort of very democratizing in some way. And statues are not very democratic, actually. In a way, they're a sort of reaction against that a bit, and sometimes quite specifically, actually, in the late 19th century, they were a reaction against socialist ideas.
Right, a sort of bulwark against the people. Yeah,
absolutely. Like, don't you get any ideas? Here's your heroes. You know, look, they're rich people. There you go.
Yes, you're not one of them, you realise.
Exactly.
Yeah. When I was reading your book, I had this image come to me that I don't think really works, but it just got in my mind. The idea that a lot of the statues referred to are like staples, like, you know, staples from a staple gun, mm-hmm. that they're sort of staples holding together completely opposing histories and interests. So, you know, you have the ruling class and you have the people, but they're kind of, you try and stamp this staple to hold these tectonic plates together, and it works for a while, but the tectonic plates keep shifting.
Yes, that's basically true. I mean, and you can't really, much as, I mean, if you look at the history of, you know, propaganda generally in all its various forms, and that's what statues really are usually, is propaganda. They're, you know, I mean, it depends on the statue a bit, but they mostly are kind of a statement in favour of a particular virtue or cause. I mean, what you can see from the whole history of it is that you can, you know, you can sustain these stories for a bit, but actually somebody pretty much always ends up challenging them one way or another.
Yes. Yes. Funny enough, it's interesting how you talk about the excuses people say, or the reasons people say why you must never move a statue, and have literally the same words emerge again and again over time. You know, you're erasing history, you can't rewrite history of their time, all these things. And they come up again and again in completely different contexts, which is intriguing. And I noticed one just a couple of weeks ago when there was the statue put up of Princess Diana, and I'm sure you were reading the papers around that as well, if it's of interest to you. And the princes, I don't know if it was Harry or William, they specifically said, we want her image now to be preserved forever. And I thought it's interesting, because of course that is what statues tell you they are about, but nothing lasts forever. It's as simple as that.
And I mean, that was literally pretty much word for word exactly what was said about Lenin. That his image had to be preserved forever. And, you know, we can see how that goes. I mean, it's, you know, not always successful. I mean, statues are an attempt, very much unlike postcards in this respect, to sort of, I mean, very literally, to set the past in stone, to create a permanence and a permanent image. And actually what we can see looking at the history of it is that they are very not permanent. That permanence
is challenged.
They're
often quite hard to get rid of. But
some of them are.
If the will is there.
Yeah, people manage it. Well, that's it.
I was amused to hear about the number of statues which actually just collapsed under their own weight because they were rather badly planned.
Yes, that has happened to a few, especially the early ones. They sort of, you know, sort of Georgian period, they made them out of lead, and it turned out that just sort of eventually was just too soft. It kind of melted, basically.
The horse's legs just buckling or something.
Yeah, they did. They just sort of flopped, which you know is its own wonderful image, really, isn't it?
Yes,
my goodness.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, stone and bronze are harder to get rid of. People do though. I mean, even in the book, I'd sort of pointed out that Queen Victoria is particularly hard to pull over, because, you know, if you sort of see she's you know, often sort of depicted sitting in a throne with big skirts, and so she's kind of a pyramid. Now, pyramids are the hardest shape to knock over, and then of course minutes later in Canada they were pulling over statues of Queen Victoria. So actually people do, if they want to, they absolutely
Those skirts, she wasn't silly.
No, she's very solid.
Ballast.
Yeah. You usually need a crane to get rid of Queen Victoria, but you know.
That's your next book, How to Get Rid of Statues. No. Statues don't have to be evil.
No, exactly. It's up to people. It's up to communities to make these decisions, in my opinion.
Definitely. Well, thank you. Thank you for taking us to Seville and embroidering the story behind it. That was very good. I'll do you another quick one of mine, which is, and we haven't actually gone away from statues. This is a picture of the Market Square in Shrewsbury, as I call it. And I think if you live there, you call it Shrewsbury. It's from 1968. It's an old card. And, well, I won't give you the message yet. We can just have a quick look at the front of it, because, of course, anyone who's visited Shrewsbury knows that there's a very prominent statue of Robert Clive, Clive of India, in the square. And that's been contested recently itself, I think. Are you aware of this one, Alex?
Absolutely, sure you are. This well, Clive is very controversial. There's one of him in London and this one in Shrewsbury. And there were a couple of petitions against this. There was also a petition in favour of the Clive statue last year, and I think the council voted to keep it, but to contextualise it, they want to put up a plaque somewhere near it, or a sort of info board. That's
I think it's been funded. Yeah,
it has been funded. I mean, what I will say is that these very rarely work. I mean, we'll see. Good luck to them. But there are incidents. I mean, you know, in the book, there's a couple of years ago, a town in Virginia tried to put up all the kind of World War II Allied leaders. So, you know, Churchill, Truman, Roosevelt, and of course Stalin. And they put the statue up, and they had a little plaque next to it saying Stalin killed lots of people and was bad, but nobody reads the plaque, so everyone just got very upset, and they had to take it down after 3 months. So, so I don't know whether this plaque will really satisfy people. So we'll
wait
and see.
It's difficult, because the plaque, to some extent, would work if it just adds detail and nuance. But if it effectively says, this person, frankly, is not worthy of a statue, you've kind of built yourself a contradiction. It doesn't really work.
Then what are you doing? And actually, well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, then still the statue is a form of glorification. So ultimately, if you know, putting a footnote at the bottom of it doesn't necessarily, people don't read the footnotes. So, so I'm not sure that will keep anyone very happy. But we'll see. We'll see what they do.
Yes. And you know, it's a very handsome figure in the middle of a beautiful square. You know, aesthetically, I rather like it, but I have great misgivings about the politics of it.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, there's definitely there's actually a campaign called Remove Clive now, run by some young people, and I think quite a lot of historians are quite sympathetic to that one, because he's pretty questionable. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, to sort of look beyond him, which perhaps is appropriate, just looking at this picture, you've got this shop on the right, Grocott. Can you see that?
Mm.
Well, I looked at that. That's long gone. I think that went... in fact, I think it's long gone in 1968, because, look, it's empty. Mm. And in the windows, and I got my magnifying glass out, they're army recruiting posters. So I think it's been taken over as a temporary army recruitment area. And this gets better, because if you then look behind the yellow car, and this is quite hard to see on your on your screen, it may not be hard, there's some kind of heavy artillery. Can you see it in green? You maybe can't see it really. I looked on the magnifying glass.
Oh, yeah. No, you can.
So they must have had a temporary sort of recruitment thing going on, and maybe that was the attraction that all the kids and young people were going to have a look at, and then into the old Grocotts to see if you want to sign up to join the army. But now they, well, maybe, I don't know what they have during lockdown, but before they had little market stalls selling honey and you know, lavender bags and things. So it's slightly different. Anyway, I will do the message quickly, which is sent to someone in Weston-super-Mare in Somerset. It says, having a divine time. There you go. That's what you want, having a divine time. Went, and there's no anteaters at all in this one, Jack. Having a divine time. Went on a 6-mile hike yesterday. Blisters, aching bones, etc., etc. Thought the chap on the front looked like Grandma Norman. Love, Angela. So, that they didn't have to take the statue down. That was the ultimate put down. Looks like Grandma Norman.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You're listening to Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast, and my guests today are Alex von Tanzelmann and Jack McNamara. A surprise, we've received a postcard. Now, postcard is from Mrs. Coleman of Guildford in Surrey, and Mrs. Coleman says, 1, 90%, 2, the coniferous forest, 3, well-behaved dogs, and 4, £2. Well, I'm sorry, Mrs. Coleman, they're the wrong answers. Good luck next time. On with the postcard stories. Now, Jack, what's the second card that you've got for us?
Well, this is a picture of Alfred Hitchcock with a really long cigar sticking out of his mouth and a bird perched on the end of it. And he's kind of staring at the camera in his typical kind of sardonic way. I can't tell if that's a real bird. I mean, I think it must be some sort of odd model. Yeah, this was sent to me. This was just a bit of a surprise postcard, which is why I chose to include it, and sort of meaningful to me, I guess. Which
so
is
we're
that,
away from your fake messages now into the real
thing. This is not fake. This is real. This is real. Yeah, this was actually sent to me. So when I kind of began my time directing shows in 2000, whatever, six or so, you know, it was quite typical, I guess. Every door was closed. It was all about people saying no. And the only person who said yes to me was a quite famous American novelist called Don DeLillo, who had written a play, which I wanted to do. And all of the kind of industry people around were like, no chance, no chance, you're a nobody. But he undercut them and gave me the UK premiere rights to this play.
Wow.
Which is really kind of him. And so I put that on and it went well. And then it led to me doing another piece of work of his, and I've now done three pieces of Don DeLillo's work for the Good first Lord. Time in the UK, and always with his very kind kind of blessing. But I guess what's interesting is that we would correspond. I mean, our first correspondence was by phone, but other than that, we would correspond by letter, and he always would write with a typewriter. I think all his novels are typewritten, and I would get these, you know, this letter through the post. I'd open it, and it would be a quite formal typewritten letter from him answering a question or telling me about a scene or saying, yes, I could do this or that. And we would just kind of write back and forth. My letters were kind of boring, you know, printed computer paper letters, but I get these lovely typewritten things. And then so we'd done a few things together, and then I, you know, I moved to Nottingham and ran the company I'm running now, and I did a show about Alfred Hitchcock and took it to New York, and New York is where DeLillo is based. So I just thought I'd send him a little letter, and I'd just say, look, I'm in New York, show about Hitchcock. I knew he loved Hitchcock because he'd written a book called Point Omega, which talked about Hitchcock.
Right.
I said, if you and your wife would like to come, but no pressure, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, I got in response this. And so it was a postcard, not a letter for the first time, which I was just very pleased about because it kind of marked a tiny change in our correspondence. Yeah, exactly. So I got this Hitchcock postcard from him. And in it, he tells two jokes. Which was even more of a surprise, or sort of jokes. Do you want me to read it to you?
I would love to.
So it just says a picture of Hitchcock, like I said, and it says on the back, and I like the fact that a postcard begins answering a question, but it just says, Jack, thanks for letting me know. Sure, two tickets May 2nd. Hope to see you. And then he writes in brackets, has the armed unit of the T.S. Eliot Protection Society given permission? That's a joke, I think. And that's because the play was called... The play was called The Love Song of Alfred J. Hitchcock, which is a version of the Eliot poem, you know, Proof Rock. So I guess he must have some knowledge that the people who guard Eliot's work are very fierce. So there was a kind of a little dig there. And so he does that joke at T.S. Eliot Protection Society, and he says, best Don DeLillo. And then he does another joke, which is in brackets again, he says, not to mention the Hitchcock Psycho Ward. And I mean, again, I don't fully understand it, but I was just so grateful to be joked at this point. So I guess, you know, the combination.
He didn't have to, did he?
He didn't have to, no. And he came along with his wife, and that was great. But yeah, I suppose it's meaningful to me because it was just a big surprise to get it. And I think also just him as a figure, because he's a writer I've always loved. The fact that he was really the first person to kind of give me the green light on something, I guess I'll kind of always remember. So. Yeah,
and you got to meet him there.
Yeah, we'd met a couple of times when I was working on his shows, and then that was the first time we met in a kind of slightly more, you know, informal way. He came with his wife and watched the show. We were slaughtered in New York for that show.
Oh,
yeah, we received a review which I absolutely love in the New York Post, which described the show as lifeless British dirge. You know, other than that, people really liked it and it went well. But it was a big mixed.
Well, they
experience
are famous for
there.
The cruelty of their reviews, aren't they?
Yeah. So we were grateful to receive that, and it's a good set of words.
Because DeLillo is more known for these enormously fat novels, isn't he?
Well, he was, I think, in the kind of 70s and 80s, yes, but recently they've become kind of slimmer and slimmer.
Have they? So he's wearing out less of those typewriters.
Yeah. I think in the last 10 years they've been sort of almost novella-sized.
Okay. Well, maybe I should rejoin the fan club because sometimes they can be quite intimidating, those books.
Yeah, I think his last one actually is set out in a typewriter font. I think it's all you know, straight from a typewriter, and it's literally tiny. It's like a kind of prose poem. So yeah, I mean they're great pieces of work.
Looking at the picture on this, the Hitchcock picture, it reminds me that. Obviously, we all know Hitchcock's films, and there was a sort of aesthetic to those films and a look to those films, and he created innovations in the visual language for film. But Hitchcock as a personality, there was kind of a visual style created around him, wasn't there, with these strange, always slightly sinister images for television or for promotional shots. And this is so typical, having this bird, obviously refers back to the birds, but on the cigar. Something there was a whole Hitchcock non-film aesthetic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that he was, and this is partly what that play that we did talked about, is that he was kind of a bit the opposite to how we are today. He was kind of constantly trying to send up the seriousness of what he was talking about.
Yes.
So you know, arguably,
humor, wasn't there?
Yeah, because so you know, if you dig into a film like Psycho, you know, it seems to just be really about. Lots of very complicated sort of psychosexual issues and hang-ups. and when people would ask him, what is this film about? He'd say, oh, it's just a joke. You know, it's just a kind of, it's a piece of Pulp Fiction. So it's like he was continually trying to hide how personal these films were to him and what they kind of said about him, I think. So I think this picture is that, again, you know, he was getting a lot of controversy around this film, The Bird. So I think sticking a bird on a cigar like that and kind of smirking at the camera, you know, seems to be part of his campaign to kind of, I don't know, almost lighten his image.
Yes. Probably the most famous director as a director, I don't know, ever? Maybe or until Tarantino, perhaps? Sort of someone who their image became as important as their films. I don't know. Mm. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a striking image. But yes, absolutely. I mean, of course, Hitchcock put himself in his own films quite deliberately.
Yes,
you know, he helped build that image, and you can definitely see him here gleefully playing up to it. You know, certainly making himself a bit of a star. You won't see many film directors making themselves quite such a recognisable figure.
No.
But of course, in recent years, there's been much more controversy over Hitchcock and his personal life around the kind of Me Too stories dating well back to his time. Perhaps that
are there specific stories like that? I don't want to go into it detailed, but you know, I know he treated actors like cattle famously, but was it rather
pretty
more
much
worse
the
than
women
that?
One and worse, not quite how you would treat cattle. Certainly, okay. Tippi Hedren on the set of The Birds had plenty to say, so you can look into that. But
let's enjoy the films.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of those.
Film's
of
great.
Those.
Yeah.
Was he from Walthamstow?
I think that might be right.
Somewhere like that.
Yeah, I've just forgotten. Far East London. I've forgotten now exactly where he was.
I know he made films in Islington, I think, at first when he started out on the canal.
Yeah, and he kind of, you know, he was sort of famous here, but I think going to America is when he kind of became the Hitchcock that we all know, you know, this sort of grinning figure. I think that all took off for him in America.
Well, then there's a sort of sense that when you did your show in New York, it was a bit of that transatlantic cultural exchange. It makes sense.
Yeah, I think the press were quite excited at the idea of retelling that story. You know, they loved the idea in America that they had kind of brought him to full kind of fruition. And then they slaughtered the show critically. So, you know, it's a kind of, that's the...
Oh, dear. But you've got up again. You're not, this is...
No.
It's now a fond memory.
Yeah. No, we it's always fun to get a big range of responses to what you do. You know, it's part of the fun. If you get over the short term pain of it, I think it's great, and you learn things as well.
And they're noticing you.
Yeah. We learned that we were lifeless British dirge out there. It was a positive thing.
I can only admire your spirit. Now I think we've got one more card to come from Alex. What's your final card for us, Alex?
So my final card, this is one that's much more recent in my life, although the image actually is also from the 1980s. It's a photograph of a woman in a cinema on her own, wearing what looks to be a rather luxurious fur coat. Some of the more details about this, it's actually by a Lebanese photographer called Fouad Al-Khoury, who is very famous mostly for extraordinary photographs of the war in Lebanon and so on. But this photo was taken in Cairo in 1987, and it's actually of the Egyptian film star Sherry Han, who was a very big star of the 80s and 90s. I saw this actually, so, you know, my last probably kind of last big trip before the pandemic was a wonderful holiday to Beirut with a couple of friends of mine. We'd all always wanted to go and went, and we just had the most wonderful time. And I saw this image in a kind of art shop museum type place when we were there. And I just, you know, sometimes you see an image and you just kind of come to a full stop in front of it. It just absolutely cut through me in the most extraordinary way. And I think, you know, I was trying to sort of figure out why.
Well, I entirely agree with you, but tell me why you think that.
You know, sometimes something just gets you. And this did, I think, partly it's, you know, I mean, obviously as a kind of massive lifelong film fan myself, there is something about the kind of woman on her own in the cinema
It's you a bit.
It's me a bit, but it's also kind of an audience, and it's just that sort of looking so kind of fixed on the screen and kind of wrapped in this coat and kind of, and there, and it's a very glamorous cinema as well. You can see it's got some lovely sort of panelling at the back and all these quite beautiful, well-kept chairs. And I think something about it, just her expression and the picture really just kind of got me as a fan. I thought, gosh, I feel there's something about this picture just speaks of the love of cinema in a way that I find quite extraordinary.
And it's a sort of reversal, I guess. She's the actress, but she's looking at the screen.
Absolutely. So. And I think that's, you know, something for us. And I mean, you know, I'm sure for Jack as well, but, you know, anyone who is a maker of theatre or film or books or anything is usually first and foremost a great lover of those things. So we do all occupy this position of looking at and being looked at and this kind of complicated relationship. And actually, I was just I think what Jack just said was so brilliant about getting slated and bad reviews and all of that. I mean, my goodness, we have certainly all had those. And it can be incredibly painful, but absolutely agree with this attitude that you sort of have to just, you know, treat this as part of the work, really. You have to kind of pick yourself up and see what you can learn and carry on, because the other option is, I don't know, falling back into a hole and never coming out again. Well, you can't do that. So So we have to proceed.
I think another thing that's nice about this picture is Egyptian film stars live a very glamorous life. And the trappings of Hollywood glamour and the way they're photographed normally are very, very glamorous and very much in the glamour and the glitter. And this one is solitary and reflective. So it's like a scene from a film rather than a shot of a film star. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, of course, she is still there in her great big fur coat, very necessary in Cairo, no doubt, at all times.
Terribly chilly. famously.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, but that's of course a marker of glamour. And I mean, I know that obviously fur coats now, a lot of people would really rather not, but certainly in the past, they were such a signifier of glamour and success. And as I say, this photo is from back in 1987, so that's a lot of people were still wearing them there. But you will still see if you go to, I mean, I was stunned when we were in Beirut just to, you know, I guess it was kind of about March time. And so it was still, you know, it wasn't boiling hot or anything, but it was also not really that cold. And certainly seeing on Sunday morning, the Beiruti society ladies going to church, all of them wearing massive fur coats when it was definitely too warm to do that.
Brilliant. Well, you've given us a little snapshot there, literally, of of both, really, of your going to Beirut to buy a picture of a cinema in Cairo. Or is it a cinema in Beirut?
No, the cinema is in Cairo.
I'm sure it is, yes. Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you very much. Well, look, thank you very much, both of you, for sharing these cards with me and with our listeners. I've said it before, I never know where the cards will send us. And I'm delighted that you both shared them with us and with our growing band of podcast listeners. Another quick reminder for everyone at home, images of all these cards, the correct ones, they're going to be on the blog at postcardfromthepast.co.uk. And before we let Alex and Jack off the line and back to their busy lives, I've got just one more card for us all to consider. It's customary for us to end the show on one of these. I would normally pass this across to you to look at across the desk. You're going to have to look at your sheet. I don't know if you can see the last card in your document, Alex and Jack.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what we've got there, Jack.
Oh. oh no. Is this the one with the church?
Exactly right.
Church?
Exactly right.
That's about as much as I could say. I don't know where.
Well, it's an aerial shot, I guess, from another church spire or something, probably looking down on a what looks to be a. Well, it's an Eastern European city. I can tell you what it is. It's a picture of a town in Hungary called Sopron, about which I know very little except apparently it's a good wine growing area, which is nice, and. You can probably see there's a dot in the middle of the card. And it is, in fact, a postcard, which is also a record. A record you'd play on a record player. And so this one is from, as I say, it's Sopron in Hungary. There's something written on the back in Hungarian, and I think it's basically it's saying it was bought in 1963. Possibly November 1963. Now, obviously, we're all in different bits of the world today, but young Tom from Wardour Studios has taken the precaution of recording the music from this record. He has it in some kind of digital compression, and if we ask him very nicely, he might be able to play it for us, and we can hear what it sounds like, listening to a postcard.
Oh, that is very jolly.
It's jollier than the rooftops suggest, isn't it?
It is. Yes.
You didn't see the band in the market square.
No, they've been on the local wine.
Yes, exactly. Maybe it's the wine festival. I think it's a singer who, if I've got this right, it's a singer called Chirok Lajlo. But, that could even be the name of the song. I don't really know.
Is it postcard sized?
No, it's slightly oversized. It's probably a little bit more than double size.
Okay. Wow.
And it's shiny, and in the laminate, as it were, are the grooves.
Wow. Incredible. But, and can you post this with a stamp? I mean, can you post it?
I think in Hungarian it says, whatever you do, don't post it without an envelope. No, without it. But there's a room for... there's a mark for the stamp. And I have got some. I've got quite a lot of these. There are some that have been sent. And they kind of survive, amazingly.
Wow. Amazing.
So, it's not even scratched.
No, it sounds really good.
There you go. Well, as the view of Sopron continues to rotate at exactly 45 revolutions per minute, that's it for this time on Podcasts from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their past, Jack McNamara and Alex von Tunzelman. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me at Past Postcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardorstudios.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.